Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the Rugby Dungeon. Thank you for listening, thank you for subscribing, and of course thank you for leaving us iTunes reviews. If you want to get involved with any banter or chat, follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Beardmore. This podcast is at the Rugby Dungeon, and of course there is the world's biggest rugby podcast, the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast. Me, Tim and Phil, every week at Rugby Podcast. Today's guest is Gareth Delve. I've been wanting to talk to Gareth for ages because he's got such a wide range of experience playing at Gloucester, Bath, Melbourne Rebels, played in Japan, and lately in the Ospreys. Really fascinating guy. So here we go. This is my interview with Gareth Delve. Hope you enjoy it. What are you up to now?
So at the moment, it's been a bit of a strange old year. Obviously finished up Ospreys last year in May, so been finishing off my Masters at uni, so got a dissertation, a couple of exams coming up next month.
Yeah.
And I've been doing a business management placement.
Oh, excellent.
At Apple, actually, yeah, so insurance. So trying to get a bit of real-world experience and, sort my ankle out.
Is that why you left the Ospreys, actually?
Yeah, so that's what happened. I did ankle ligaments and sort of eventually got it fixed up last October. So I'm about sort of 6 months post-operation and sort of still trying to get back running, really. So it's been a bit of a long haul. But sort of starting to move a bit more freely now. And it's good, obviously, with a little one spreading all around the place. So, starting to keep up.
Working on your agility.
Yeah. She's got me beaten at the moment for pace and agility. So, yeah, nothing new.
So, what exactly is the issue with the ankle? Was it ligaments? Have you broken it? Why is it taking so long to heal?
It was just a real nightmare, to be honest. I did ligaments, came down in a line out and tore the ligaments, and then just landed on someone's foot, blew them out. And it's just taken a bloody age, and I didn't end up getting the operation till 10 months. Post injury, so that didn't help, and then eventually I had to go and get it sort of fixed up myself, and I suppose just on the way back now, so it was sort of 3 months on crutches and 6 to 12 months hopefully until I can sort of see where it is, but it's been a long old haul.
Yeah, well, at least you've not wasted your time in the meantime, eh?
No, that's it, mate. Yeah, it's been good. I think, the PlayStation's gone to one side since the little one got born. And, it'd be nice to have a couple of letters behind my name come the end of this summer and get the Masters done.
See, I have seen you play since I can remember it, really. And I was looking you up on Wikipedia. You're only 34. So are we likely to see you back in a rugby shirt at any time?
I don't know, mate. It's a tough one. I think it's looking unlikely, if I'm honest, mate. It's something I haven't really made a final decision on because I've been sort of waiting to see how the ankle healed up, and if I felt great, then there'd be no reason not to look to carry on. But it's sort of 18 months now, really, since I did the injury, and just time dragging on. The game's moving on. It's one of those where I don't know. There's not too many clubs, you know, I'm too keen to play for either. So, you know, so I've got an affinity with a few of my old clubs, but I don't know. Everything would have to be right. And of course, the ankle would have to be 100% for me to get back into it. And it's not looking too likely at the moment.
Would you ever look at playing just as, you know, just as recreation? Or for you, is it when you're involved and you want to be at the highest level you can?
I think it has been that, you know, I've got to be honest. You know, most of the enjoyment I was getting through my career, you know, as a back rower, the nature of the game, you're busting yourself up and you're smashing other people about. You know, it's a tough old game. You know, there's obviously some games you enjoy and you're right in the middle of it and you got that feeling for it. But I think what I always loved was, you know, sort of that feeling of being close to my teammates, having that camaraderie and that bond. And you'd run through a brick wall for them. So I think doing that at a different level, and I suppose, you know, a lot of my mates and a lot of the guys I spent a lot of my career with are sort of finishing up.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult to get back to that level of enjoyment, you know, without having that friendship around it. So potentially if it was that that bond was there and it was the team that I had something that, you know, I cared about, then it'd be worth going around or, you know, we playing somewhere nice and warm. But I always hated playing in the heat, mate, to be honest.
So really?
Even some of these Bermuda things, you know, I bloody sweat like a beast. So I'd be there melting away and not enjoying it at all. So, yeah, you know, maybe those days are gone.
Just on what you said then, I don't think it matters what level of rugby you play. You do get a certain age, and I reckon it's about 29. And then overnight, you feel like one of the older guys in the change room. Come about 31, half your mates have retired.
Yeah, and it was strange. I think it probably happened to me, you know, after my second year at the Rebels, and, you know, I had some great mates all the way through at the Rebels, but, you know, the likes of Stirling Mortlock, you know, Michael Lippmann, you know, those guys, Julian Huxley, they moved on, Mark Gerrard moved on, and some of them retired, some of them went to play elsewhere. And they were probably my really close mates in the team. I had some great mates within the club, but they were younger.
Yeah.
So then the following year, you're going out for a pint with the lads, and they're 22, 23, and it's just a different world, mate. It's, you know, it's not, you know, they're fantastic guys and we're really close, but, you know, it's just different stages of your life. So I think that was a bit of a turning point. And, you know, the more you think about it, the more I reflect across my whole career. It was always those bonds and friendships that, you know, sort of kept me hungry. So looking at the match day program, I remember when 1982 with the youngsters and the kiddies, and now you see lads running around. You know, obviously Keelan Giles was coming through last year at the Ospreys, and I think, you know, it's pretty much 98 or 99.
Oh,
so
it's terrifying when you read the dates of birth.
Yeah, that's it.
When you read a date of birth and you realise that you had a Beano from the same year, that's when you feel really old.
Yeah. So that's it. Everything's moved on, mate. You know, and all the kids have just got their heads in their smartphones now. Swiping around on Tinder, so it's not for me.
That's when you know you're really, really old. Let's just stick with the Rebels a second, because I was going to ask you about them a little bit later on, but as we're there, we'll stick with it now. That was a strange team, wasn't it? Because there was nothing there before you arrived, and then you arrived. Was it like you, Danny Cipriani, were the first year of their professional existence? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you were also there for the, you know, for the beginning.
Yep.
There had been the ARC, it was called at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was ARC or NRC. So they'd had like a national comp that they were looking to put in between the Shoot Shield and Super Rugby.
Yeah.
Just to sort of bridge the gap and increase awareness across Australia. So Melbourne had a team that came down, did really well. I think David Croft was part of that, Matt Cobain, and, you know, had some really good guys that had put a bit of a bedrock down in Melbourne. But then they hadn't got the license when the Force got it. So, you know, when we came in 2011, got down there 2010, it was a brand new team and, you know, just a great opportunity because, superb sporting city.
Yeah.
We had, you know, the run of everything. We had, you know, fantastic support. Rod McQueen obviously involved, you know, at the coaching level. And, you know, Harold Mitchell, who was a, you know, massive advertising giant in the city, good mates with, you know, with the Packers and, yeah, everyone else down there. So, you know, it was just a huge opportunity. And because it was brand new, you know, everyone just came together and, you know, created a really tight bond from the start.
Just give me a bit of background about the Rebels, because obviously I've seen them play. I didn't even realise this until I was listening to an episode of the Green and Gold podcast. They're privately owned, yeah?
The Rebels. Yeah, they are again now. So initially when we started, we were privately owned.
Yeah.
Harold Mitchell, you know, bought the licence and, you know, had us privately owned. It then went back to the AIU,
yeah,
you know, a couple of years back. And then Andrew Cox has come in, who's, you know, he's a New Zealand businessman who's lived in Melbourne for years and obviously with a passion for rugby. He's taken over the license again, so privately owned again at the moment. And I suppose, you know, that's been a good thing with everything going on,
yeah,
around the Sanzar decisions.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. How did they persuade you to go to a completely new team?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a tough decision, I've got to be honest, because the, you know, I suppose the key options at that time, that's sort of whittled down, so either going back to Cardiff, you know, to the Blues,
mm-hmm,
and I had a, you know, had a great offer from them. I, you know, pretty much the offer of the captaincy. I'd been captain in Gloucester for a couple of seasons,
yeah,
and obviously I just got back into the Welsh team, you know, for the previous Six Nations. So it was a huge carrot to go home, and obviously the family being there, and you know, it would have been a fantastic, you know, life in a way. But I suppose I'd grown up watching a lot of Super Rugby, and for me, with the disappointments of the international career not quite kicking off, you know, either picking up injuries and missing out on the opportunities to play the best teams. You know, it was only South Africa out of the Tri-Nations teams I'd had the chance to play against.
Yeah.
I just thought this is going to be my one chance, really, to play against the best in the world on their own patch in Super Rugby, and, you know, to be the first guy to go and do it. So, you know, obviously there hadn't been another Welshman to do it. It was a brand new team. There was the chance to create something, you know, in a fantastic sporting city. And I think that just swayed the balance in the end. It was special, you know, the chance to start a new team, because obviously Bath and Gloucester are both nearly, well, Bath are 152 years old now.
Yeah, that's right.
And obviously, you know, Gloucester are coming up to it, you know, in 1873. So to go and create a team with a load of brand new mates on the other side of the world in a pretty special city was, you know, a bit of a once-in-a-lifetime chance.
See, I can only imagine if I wanted to get you on to the Melbourne Rebels, I'd have to call you and say, Stirling Mortlock signed. And then I'd have to call Stirling Mortlock and say, Gareth Delve signed.
Yeah, I don't know if Stirling would have known who I was at the time, to be honest. But, you know, and Danny got a fair few of the headlines. But,
yes,
yeah, that was the amazing thing for Stirling and Rod to be involved with it. You know, Rod had been a successful businessman for about 10 years. It was, you know, probably, was it 8 years since he'd won the Lions series, you know, with the Wallabies, no,
yeah,
sorry, longer, 10 years since he'd won that. And so for him to come out of it, it did give hell of a lot of credibility and kudos to the team. So, you know, to go and be a part of that was great. And then by the time we actually got down there and saw how much, you know, Harold Mitchell had rolled out the red carpet in Melbourne for us, you know, we were having these huge Weary Dunlop dinners. And Weary Dunlop was, you know, he's an Australian hero. He'd been in a prisoner of war, I think it was.
Oh, okay.
In the Second World War. And so we'd have these dinners named after him. He's one of the first Melbournean, you know, rugby players.
Yeah.
And he'd have about 1,000 people there packing out.
Is that right?
You know, the Crown Casino. Yeah, yeah.
That's
it was
amazing.
Incredible. We'd have about 3 or 4 a year. Every one of them packed with about, you know, 800 to 1,000 people. You'd have the Prime Minister at the time, Tony Abbott, would come and speak. And, you know, I suppose the access we had to the top of town in Melbourne and the chance to get out and do different things amongst the community, which is massively AFL-based, was unbelievable.
Did you manage to get out much? And watch much AFL?
Yeah, we'd go and watch, mate, and we'd, you know, it was amazing. I'll never forget going to watch Carlton and Richmond, which is one of the sort of local derbies. Mm. But it was a Thursday night game, and you've got about 80,000 people at the MCG. And just thinking, you know, there are 10 teams within the city, and, you know, often they're getting crowds of 40 to 50,000, and, you know, the big teams getting 80, 90,000 plus. And you think the only other place that would be anywhere equivalent would be, you know, say the Manchester Derby in football,
yeah,
or some of the London Derbies in Premier Football. But
with much
the guys were so accessible
too,
and, you know, down to earth, it was a brilliant place.
I was talking to Ben Darwin, who I believe was part of the initial setup with the Rebel.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, he's a fascinating bloke. And one of the things he alluded to was when you set up the Rebels, They had lots of senior players like yourself, like Stirling Mortlock. How difficult was it to kind of put your impression on that team? And did you feel that there's lots of different personalities trying to pull the team in different ways? Not in a bad way, but all trying to be leaders at the same time?
I think you always get that, you know, because it's, I suppose there's any sort of leadership or any sort of group dynamics. You get the, you're in the storming phase, and we'd all been chucked in together. Some of the guys knew each other from Sydney.
Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of the international boys had known each other through the years. But I think that first team, we had, I think it was 12 players that had captaincy experience, you know, either at Super Rugby level or, you know, myself at sort of Premiership level. And so the dynamics were, you know, they were great in one way. You got so many leaders. But I thought it was brilliant in a way because I was expecting, you know, obviously Stirling was captain, you know, for the first couple of years, but I suppose for me to be given the honour of being the vice-captain coming over as a foreigner was great. And I think that was testament to the fact that although there was that many leaders, it was an element of, you know, meritocracy. It wasn't about where you were from or coming across as a foreign player. Mm-hmm. And I think to do that with a brand new team was different. Whereas if you go into a team now, you know, you're going to have things embedded and you're going to have, you know, the social side set up. There's going to be a few cliques that you have to break down and all the rest. So, you know, I think there were some difficulties chucking a load of new personalities into one city and into one group so quickly. But I think if anything, you know, we did very well with that, you know, especially in that first season. Mm. And then obviously managing different things. Like I say, with any team, you've got different mentalities, different sort of priorities. And, you know, that's the challenge of leadership is getting everyone on the same page and go in the same direction.
And how do they go about integrating you all? I think a little bit more usual.
Loads of booze, mate. That was the key, innit? That was the way. We had a few, you know, big get-togethers. We'd go down to Lorne, which is you know, a beautiful place on the Great Ocean Road.
Yeah.
And we had about 3 or 4 days down there together. We'd do some training, come up with, you know, obviously the team priorities and principles. Mm. You know, I guess it was. And you know, I suppose work out who we wanted to be as a squad, and you know, I guess around there we'd have a few beers in the evening and get to know each other. So yeah, we, you know, we did a lot in that sense, you know, in following years we do a couple of army camps and things like that, but you know, ultimately it was that first phase of just getting to know each other and getting on the same page.
Sounds absolutely brilliant. You're selling it to me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's it, mate. It doesn't take much selling, honestly. You get down to Melbourne and you know, it's one of those amazing places that has just got everything going on, but it's got that small town feel, you know, where everyone's got a bit more time for each other and, you know, there seems to be a bit more warmth and genuinity to people. But, you know, and as a team, because all the guys were from interstate or international, you know, we relied on each other so heavily. And, you know, for me and, you know, my Mrs. Helen, like it was a great experience, great time of our lives.
It sounds absolutely incredible. And talking to you about it, the warmth which you speak about Melbourne makes me think, would you swap your experiences at Melbourne and at Japan for more appearances for Wales? Or are you quite happy the way that everything worked out?
Yeah, I'm happy. You know, I knew when I left, because like I say, it was a fairly clear-cut decision. You know, if I'd gone back to Cardiff, I'd have had a leadership role. You know, I was offered the captaincy to go back to the Blues. And I was back into the Welsh squad, but it wasn't that I disrespected that. I just felt that, you know, by that point, I'd actually been in the Welsh squad for, what was I when I left? 7 years. Mm-hmm. You know, so I got my first cap played my first game at 20. Didn't get my first cap until 23 then because I'd got injured in that game at 20 and missed, you know, 2003 World Cup. So I felt it was always that element of, there wasn't a lot of continuity while I'd been around the Welsh squad. We'd have a lot of new coaches. I was always playing over the bridge. So
yeah.
I suppose by the time I'd made my mark on the team, I'd either get injured, in all honesty, or the coach would change. And sometimes they'd come from the regional setup and then you're fighting again to push your nose in front. And I suppose for me, it was a case of taking control of my own career and doing things that I wanted out of it. Because I spent my whole career, I wanted to be the best player in my position in the world. Mm. And I wanted to play against the best players in my position in the world. And for me, that was, your All Blacks and, you know, your South Africans, the likes of Piers Peace and those guys. And in a sad way, in 2008, I just got the Welsh jersey as number eight, you know, for the second test in South Africa.
Mm.
And I lasted 20 minutes before I tore my cruciate again. Mm. So it was just, you know, a little bit of a feeling of saying, right, I can't really control whether I'm going to be selected the next time these games come around or whether I'm going to be in favour or whether I'm going to be injured. But if I go down and play these guys, and I'd played with Greg Somerville and Carlos Spencer, who I, you know, loved as a player at Gloucester.
Yeah.
But even those guys, you know, that was towards probably the end of their career, whereas I thought your Kieran Reid, your Pierre Spieses, you know, your Palus, your Burgers, they're all playing down there right now, and I can play against them every week. And if I get the chance to wear a Wales jersey again, I'm going to have absolutely no fear at all about playing the All Blacks, about playing the Wallabies or the Springboks. And, you know, for me, that was the decision in the end. That was my chance to go and do something for me where I wasn't going to be reliant on, you know, I suppose, selection decisions.
Now, I'm going to bring this interview back on track in a second, but I just want to take it off on a quick tangent because you mentioned a name then, Carlos Spencer. How good was he? And not just in games, but I imagine he was amazing just to train with.
Well, he was unbelievable because I think he's one of those guys that, you know, he was the reason in a way that, you know, you get out of bed in the morning on a Saturday to watch the rugby.
100%.
That's, see, my little one agrees. Yeah, save us, Fiona. But, you know, amazing showman and a fantastic player. But I guess from playing alongside him, you know, what an athlete. Like, he was 33, 34 when he turned up at Gloucester, and still incredible shape. You know, one of the hardest working guys on his, on his fitness, on his, you know, athleticism. And I suppose I'd always had that mindset in the past that these supremely talented guys, you know, it was just almost easy for them. They just turn up and they do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that professionalism was incredible. And yeah, it was, you know, it was an honour in a way to play alongside him. He didn't play a huge amount, you know, in some ways. You had Nicky Robinson as well and Freddie Burns as tens that season. And, you know, but trying to organise your defence, say, in a team run against Carlos, who's, you know, maybe got a little bit of the hump because he's not starting that weekend, and he's running the attack against you.
I can imagine. I mean,
you'd have everyone in the right place. You'd have the defence would be perfect, and he'd find a gap. You know, it'd be a bloody missed two out the back, and, you know, someone go through a hole, and you're sort of half pissed off and half applauding. You know, he's unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it before. These guys make it look easy, and I kind of put Carlos Spencer in this category of too talented to be any good. And what I mean by that is some guys, I think, are just so talented, they don't need to put in the work. But, yeah, clearly not.
Yeah, man, I disagree, you know, on the thing of, you know, he played within the team structure.
Yeah.
You know, enough. You know, I think he was one of those. Obviously, he's always going to have a reputation as a maverick because what he could do and what he had the confidence to do on the pitch was unbelievable. And probably uncoachable. You know, I think that scares some coaches because they're worried that what they're telling people to put on the field isn't going to happen. And they're worried that reflects on them. So I think at times that was a little bit why there was a difficulty to play Carlos in a team where we had quite a few younger guys within the squad and they probably needed more structure than it was thought he would get. In his last game for us, he conjured this try in the last 5 minutes. It was literally his last appearance. And he just controlled the game. And I thought, you know, it was a great way for him to sign off.
Yeah. Do you think that coaches, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, and it might be the same in the Southern Hemisphere, I don't know, but Northern Hemisphere almost fear talent because they can't coach it. They can't control what's going to happen next. So you can't build a game plan around Danny Cipriani doing a miss two out the back type thing because you just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think that is a case, you know, probably more so in the Northern Hemisphere where, you know, it's always been that little bit more attritional. I actually read David Strettel did an interview, I think, going into...
He did, actually, this week.
This weekend's game. Yeah. So I read that talking about saying coaches are viewing players on what they can't do as opposed to what they do offer.
Yeah.
And I do think that is an issue. And, you know, there's a number of factors around that. You know, the coaches, job security, they feel if they're not winning games, then, you know, they're going to be out of a job. And I can totally understand that. But in the same way, I believe a coach's job is to develop a player, to develop the team.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You know, certainly you don't accept guys who are going to go off and do their own thing to the detriment of a team. But if guys have got talents, then it's the coach's responsibility to improve their weaknesses as well, or at least tell them what the view is on their weaknesses and give that guy an opportunity to improve it. But I think too often up here, you know, they just get discarded and that's the end of it. Or the guys who have got that bit of talent are told, don't you dare throw that pass. You know, don't you dare do a Dane Coles and throw a 15-meter pass. You tuck that under your arm and you take contact. And I think we end up, you know, with guys who are playing at probably 70-80% of their potential.
Talking to you, you're obviously an incredibly rounded guy, very, very knowledgeable on rugby. And I can't help but think some of that must be because you've seen so many different ways to play and experienced so many different rugby cultures. Looking at the Welsh team at the moment and the idea of things like Gatland's Law, and they do it in England too, where you've got to be in England to play for England. Do you think that's a mistake and that more players should be travelling to Southern Hemisphere, to Japan, or even just, you know, Pro 12 players going to the Premiership and vice versa?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that it is difficult for the international coaches because I think it's not necessarily their agenda they're pushing, but it's a responsibility to the union to create the best product within the country. So the WIU rule isn't about making the for the Welsh national team. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about trying to get the best product for the regions. But I think in that way, you end up threatening people with something that shouldn't be used as a carrot, you know?
Completely agree.
Your international jersey, you earn that by being the best player in your position. And nothing else should come into it. No politics, no garbage about where you're playing. It should be about you're the best in that position, so you know you've earned the right for that. And what ends up happening is it's used as a threat. It keeps players in an environment, but then that takes away the responsibility on the regions or on the Premiership teams to create the best environment for those players to stay and to improve. You know, and obviously the first thing that's thrown out is salary and how much money people are earning in France or going here, there, and everywhere. But, you know, in my eyes, it's a global game. My life and my friendships and experience have been massively sort of helped by having that experience of traveling. You know, my ability to deal now with, obviously, you know, all likelihood not playing again is helped by the fact that I know there's a big wide world out there and it's not going to be, you know, my view of rugby in the world isn't coloured by, you know, a disappointment within, you know, one place. Yeah. So I think the more well-rounded we can make our players and athletes and, like I say, guys that go and play Super Rugby, take away that fear factor. You know, maybe we don't end up losing 12 on the bounce to the Wallabies. You know, maybe we learn what we need to do to beat the Kiwis. Maybe we, you know, use that experience to come back and tell our teammates, listen, these guys got two arms, two legs, so let's put them on a pedestal. But, you know, I suppose while there are those differences and discrepancies in, you know, salary or environment or bloody insurance or anything else within these places, I don't think you can hold a gun to people's head and say, well, if you leave, you know, you're going to lose the thing that you value the most. Because I've never been more patriotic, to be honest, JB, than, you know, when I've been over the bridge or when I've been down on the other side of the world and I'm getting up at bloody 4 in the morning to watch Six Nations. This,
yeah,
you know, it makes you realize how much you love your country. But yeah, sometimes it becomes a bargaining tool, and I think it's wrong.
Yeah, I completely with you. I think it's, I'll go further. I think it's a little bit unhealthy as well. I mean, there is something very romantic about the hometown boy growing up and playing for his hometown club. But for instance, if you grew up in Swansea, lived in Swansea, played your rugby in Swansea, I'm not for one second saying that that's a bad thing, but maybe there is an advantage of going over to Wasps for a year or going to France for a year. Yeah, the classic one is Stefan Armitage. Who was Stefan Armitage before he went to Toulon?
Exactly, yeah. And I think that, you know, the likes of Steph and, you know, Nick Abendanen, who, you know, was superb for Bath. You know, had a good few years playing with Bendy.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely brilliant. And I think both of those guys, you know, they both won the European Player of the Year while playing in France.
Yeah, that's a good
But
point.
Yet couldn't get a jersey in the England team. And both of them, to an extent, were forced out of their clubs. You know, obviously with Bendy, he had a great career with Bath. Mm. The emergence of Anthony Watson meant that he was spending less time playing. He goes across to Clermont and has been outstanding ever since.
Yeah.
You know, Stefan, by far the best seven, you know, in England for a long time. And his performances, you know, dictated it. He won a European player, I think, twice on the bounce, three Heineken Cups. And yet he can't get a jersey, even though when he was at London Irish, he wasn't on the radar because apparently he wasn't playing well enough. And, you know, I think that it's wrong. You know, it's a bit probably controversial, but, you know, when you look at it, all we've got as players, and I think, you know, now it's, I think it's great that they've now changed the residency rule and they're going to change it.
Because, do you think that's great though?
Yeah, because I think 3 years isn't long enough. Like, I loved Australia.
Yeah.
And, you know, I loved the players I played alongside, and I respected, you know, the opportunity to play in the country and the supporters and everything else. But it didn't make me Australian. You know, I was always a Welshman in Australia, and I couldn't have represented the Wallabies with a passion that a young guy who's grown up and lived his life in Sydney and played all his rugby, I wouldn't have wanted to. You know, my only view was ever to represent in Wales and making them a better team when I had the chance to play. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this whole thing about I want to play at the top level and I want to play international rugby, and, you know, I've got some great mates who've done it, played for other countries, and I love them to bits, but, you know, certainly not for me. You know, your country's your country, and that's that.
Yeah, see, that's an interesting one. I kind of have some sympathy with that position, you know, tier one to tier one countries. It's a very short career, rugby. And I look at the guys who are playing now, and say some of the guys who, like, I'm going to give you an example, like a Rocco Degouni. I just don't see why he should finish his career £500,000 short compared to someone who isn't as good as him just because the residency rule changed. I mean, it won't affect him per se, but that's just an example. Particularly if you play in tier two.
Yeah, yeah. Well, sorry, JB. Someone like Rocco Degouni, mate, he's represented this country, and he could have played for, I suppose, any of the home nations because he's represented the British Army.
Yeah, yeah.
On the biggest stage, mate. So, you know, I'm not talking about guys like him. You know, with full respect for.
No, that's a bad example. But I guess I'm meaning like someone who played in, I don't know, Namibia or somewhere like that comes over, does 3 years. As far as I'm concerned, they should be allowed to play because they can't earn that money elsewhere. And it's a very shallow view, but I just can't square the circle of giving away so much income at the end of a career.
But, yeah, I understand what you're saying, mate, but, you know, I never ever played international rugby to earn money.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the difference. I think if the unions, and I'm sure a lot of people feel the same, you know, if the unions made it free for people to come and watch, the boys would be happy to go without the money. You know, obviously the fact that you fill the, you know, you fill Twickenham or you fill, you know, the Principality Stadium and it's bringing in £5 million or however much it is, the players are going to want that cut because people are coming to see them play. They're risking their bodies and futures and health on performing. So I think it's right that there is that, you know, money paid across. But then in the same way, if that money was taken out of the picture and, you know, obviously it's a fantastic living nowadays in professional rugby, but, you know, I can't imagine anyone who grew up running around the garden saying, I'm going to earn 20 grand now to go play at Twickenham. It was, you know, I want to be Scott Cunnell running around the garden, running over the top of people at junior school because I want to play for Wales. And that's what I mean. It needs to be sort of taken back to that level, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
Some of the guys that get brought up around this argument are guys who, you know, again, like Rock Taguni, and you know, have got full rights to be playing for, you know, the country they're at. You know, obviously the likes of Tulupe, you know, he came over as a really young guy, you know, and his dad was a Tongan international, you know, playing in Welsh rugby. But Tulupe grew up as a Welsh player, you know, his whole schooling, his whole, you know, rugby education is as a Welshman. And I think that is very different to the likes of, you know, again, a Teo, who, yeah. Although I think Teo's mother is...
Teo's mother is, you know, is English. But yeah. So, I'll give you an example. Denny Solomona is the one that's going to get a bit of a stick in the next few weeks. But again, where else is he going to earn that kind of money? I think the risks that they take, it's perfectly justified.
Yeah, but I think you earn your money with your club.
Mm.
You know, and that's what I mean. If you look at the... Again, you know, it'd be a bit controversial. I find it hypocritical in that you can say, okay, Denny Solomona is more worthy of wearing an England jersey because he's playing in England than Stefan Armitage was as an Englishman who, you know, spent his whole career and his whole life wanting to play for England, but who's had to go to Toulon to make a living and to play for a Heineken Cup winning team and to get the opportunities his talent deserved. So why is he more worthy of an opportunity than Solomona?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, it also means that the England shirt is dangled to foreign players as a way to attract people to the Premiership. And I'm not particularly comfortable with that either.
Yeah, yeah, I'd agree. That's what I mean. I think, you know, it's up to the clubs and the regions and everyone else to create the best environment. You know, there's a little quote, and I'll probably get it wrong, but, you know, I read something about Branson saying, you know, you train people to give them the talent that they can leave, but you create the best environment so they don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my view, if that was the mentality behind Premiership Rugby, regional rugby, I think Premiership Rugby is certainly getting its act together, and that is stemming the flow. And obviously, you've seen the likes of Picamoles coming across from France to play at Northampton, and, you know, they're doing a great job with that. But I think there are very few teams that are investing in their culture. You know, they'll invest in players, but as much as, you know, Saracens had the Saffersons tag for a while and, you know, they got a hell of a lot of stick because they got rid of a lot of long-term players there, you know, back when Edward Griffiths went in and Brendan Venter. But they've created this Wolfpack mentality. And now you look at the young guys that have come through the system, your Owen Farrells, your Atoges, your Cruz, the number of guys they brought in from Division One rugby.
Yeah, it's huge,
isn't
it? And
they've created this culture. You know, it's no surprise because they're spending money on the guys having experiences together, whether it be going to Oktoberfest, whether it be going to Barcelona after a, you know, a big win out in Munster. It's getting guys willing to spend time with each other away from the training pitch. And that is where you get your bonds. You know, that's worth probably 50 grand on a contract talk because you don't want to leave your best mates to go and play at a different club. You want to stay. You get off the floor in the 78th minute to make that tackle because you're playing with your brothers. You know, it's a mentality that's getting lost in pro rugby, I think.
I was quite harsh on the Premiership then. I probably didn't mean to be quite so harsh because I think, as you alluded to before, that the Premiership have really got its act together. I think salary cap system works well. I think as in terms of a weekly competition, a domestic competition, I don't think there is one better. But yeah, it's interesting that you point out about the culture thing. And it also ties into something that Ben Darwin said a few weeks ago, which is the best teams have the most contractual stability. So yeah, it's quite an interesting one. Where do you see the Welsh regions in comparison to what you see in the Premiership?
I'll be fairly honest, mate, throughout, so I'll carry on. You know, I think a mile behind at the moment, you know, in many ways. And, you know, I think there's some good people who are hopefully going to do something about that in Gareth Davis and, you know, Martin Phillips. He's got a, you know, HR background. And,
yeah,
again, I think it's about creating an environment because there's certainly the talent here. But, you know, for me, it's so simplistic sometimes when guys leave Welsh rugby. You know, you look at the likes of Liam Williams, who's going to go to Saracens this year. And, you know, he's going to join a team that's just won the double and potentially going to win the double again this season. And yet people are saying, oh, he's going for the money.
He might be going for the New York trip.
Well, that's the thing. He's leaving to sort of go and, obviously, I'd imagine, you know, obviously he's got... you know, family down there, his girlfriend lives in London as well, so there's another tie.
Yeah.
But it's also the factor of going to an environment that's successful and, you know, as good a job as Wayne Pivac is doing at the Scarlets, Saracens are going to take some catching, you know, over the next few years. So either Liam's going to spend his career sort of chasing a team, or he can go to a team where he's got that opportunity to be a part of it now. You know, and I'm sure the other factors around it in terms of the environment, training environment, everything that you need to be a better player is going to be better, you know, at Saracens. And that's no real disrespect to Scarlets, because I don't know their system so well, but yeah. I do know, you know, from what I've seen from coming back to Welsh rugby, and it's genuinely not sour grapes. It's it's been some of the worst that I've seen, you know, well, throughout my whole sort of career.
I don't know what it is about Welsh rugby. I often get in trouble when I talk about Welsh rugby, because quite frankly, I've almost stopped covering it. And the reason why, it just feels so political. And although the squads are trying the hardest to win, the politics around it undoubtedly rubs off on the teams. I mean, I think, is it this week or next week, the Cardiff Blues are going to change the Blues. You could have thought the world is ending.
Yeah, you know, and I guess it is tough. I think with the Blues, you know, their situation is very difficult, because you've got a massive amount of talent up in the, you know, in the valleys and up in the Rhondda, Pontypridd. And the fact is, with Cardiff in the title, you're not going to attract, you know, those supporters.
Yeah.
And again, that's their right. You know, they've grown up supporting teams that, through no fault of their own or their decision, are now no longer, you know, the top professional setup. So you do have to engender support from them, and you do, if you want to be considered, you know, a true region, you do have to reach out and make sacrifices to do that. But I think the Blues situation is a little bit different in that, you know, Pontypridd and Bridgend came under the Celtic Warriors banner initially. Yeah. So now that got dissolved again. That was no fault of the Blues, from what I know. You know, it was a decision that was made for, you know, similar to what's going on in Australia in terms of, apparently it makes the most business sense and all the rest, with no real thought to, you know, the emotional side of it. You know, it's a business decision. Yeah. But that means then the Blues are expected to drop everything they've been doing for the first few years of regional rugby and welcome in someone else. I think the Ospreys have done it very well in terms of incorporating Bridgend into the region.
Yeah.
And they've had, you know, great success from that. You know, the likes of, you know, Reese Webb and, you know, the Bridgend boys, Haberfield and those guys that have come through from Bridgend. There's a huge amount to gain from it. But I think it is also a difficult decision, because as a capital club, you know, Cardiff have always been one of the biggest names in world rugby, you know, as have, you know, the Scarlets, as have, I suppose, Swansea and Neath. But, you know, in all fairness to the Ospreys, I do believe they've been, you know, the one team that has really embraced regional rugby.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. And,
you know, then they've reaped the benefits of it, because you look at their catchment area for talent. You've got Swansea, Neath, Aberavon, Bridgend, you know, up into the Swansea Valley. You know, it's huge. And the players you get coming through because of that, fantastic. I think if the Blues are going to sort of bring Pontypridd and the Rhondda, you know, back into the system, then they have to make a sacrifice. But I do understand why they're a bit grudging, because, you know, it wasn't how it was set up in the first place.
Yeah, now, you can probably answer this question, because it's one of these rugby myths. I don't even know if it exists or not. Is it true that Gloucester have a fairly sizable following from Pontypridd?
I'm not too sure, to be honest.
Is that actually a thing?
I think you get all sorts in the shed, to be honest, because it's a bloody great place to be. So I wouldn't be surprised, you know, just in terms of, I suppose, when people feel they've had something taken away from them, and they, you know, it's not the same, you're going to go to somewhere like-minded. And I'd imagine, you know, that passion for rugby and the way they're that, you know, that knowledge for it, you know, probably find a great home in the shed and in, you know, Teague's over the road. So yeah, yeah. Be surprised.
Well, okay, I've just got one last small set of questions to ask you. I've always wanted to kind of clarify this, but when commentators talk about players, there's usually some kind of, you know, fact or catchphrase that goes along. So I'll give you an example. Racing Metro aren't called Racing Metro anymore. They're called Dan Carter's Racing Metro. I seem to remember with you, it was always Gareth Delve, Dad was Mr. Wales. So two things. How strong are you? And was your dad Mr. Wales? Have I got that wrong?
No, yeah, dad was Mr. Wales. He won it in, I think it was 1983.
Amazing.
So it was just, it was pretty incredible as a youngster to have, the old "my dad's bigger than your dad" was, pretty easy scrap at that time. And he had a massive part to play with his training knowledge in, I suppose, my training as a younger guy. But
Wow.
I think the other one about me being super strong, yeah, that's definitely a load of crap nowadays. It's
Be
just
modest.
plodding on, really, and yeah,
So, I mean,
trying to be.
there is always a time, isn't there, in a man's life when you think, yeah, I'm probably stronger than the old man now. Have you actually come to that time?
I think so now. Yeah, dad, he still trains and he still gets back into it. But I think it's getting a bit rarer now. So I think, yeah, probably a bit stronger, but he's still the best coach I've had. So he knew me. Yeah. Well, I think the thing with dad, it was great, and I'll give you a bit of an insight sort of into growing up with him.
Yeah, please.
Anything to do with weights, I'd do it because I knew he knew his stuff. He met Arnold. He did three or four Mr. Universe competitions, so he was, and obviously an amateur situation, but he was, right at the top of his game. So anything to do with weights, I'd do. There was one time we'd go and do some running, and he'd be making, I'd go down to Tesco, be, sidestep through all those bollards over there, and so you just feel like a bit of a numpty, go and do that, come back, And there was one time me and my brother went and did some training, and at Mangdi Leisure Centre, they've got this cycle track, and it's about 800 metres round. He's like, right, me and my brother start on different sides and chase each other until you catch the other one. I'm like,
Brilliant.
nah, that's the last straw, sort of. He knew bugger all about running, but anything to do with weights was great.
So, I've also read that your dad was prop in rugby too. How was it that you found your passion in rugby rather than lifting weights?
Yeah, I don't think it was that unusual, really, because dad loved rugby. He played a part of a great team, with Cardiff Schools, and they won the Jewish Shield. He played with Terry Holmes and Ian Eidman, and some guys that went on, and obviously Terry had a amazing career with Wales and British Lions. Other guys went on to be international. So he got sort of passed over. I think he was around the Wales youth age, and one of those usual stories of, you don't make the trial or you don't get through. And I think his frustration led him into doing more training. And I think, for dad, he was just more of an individual sport kind of guy. But he had a massive passion for rugby, and I think my initial passion was for football. I
Was it
loved it,
really?
lived it, breathed it. Yeah, I wanted to be Ian Rush. So from probably the age of four, I was out the front, in the street, kicking a ball against the wall, every night, for hours on end. But I had a couple of games of rugby then, and I think the football helped because I had a bit more ability to pick my head up and, could run and beat people, that type of thing. And then it all sort of merged. Dad still loved the rugby. We found that rugby was more sociable, and I found a great home down at Romney Rugby Club in those early years, and that's where it took off. But I think for dad, he did miss that team side of it. So when I had the opportunity, he was very supportive of me being part of that team, and him and mum obviously made sacrifices for me to get to all the training. But I was just never that individually minded. Like I was saying at the beginning, my love for the game has always been, I suppose, that loyalty to my teammates and to my club. It's been about sort of leaving everything out there for them. So, I think I'd have found it hard to make the sacrifices the bodybuilders or the individual sports do, because I've always found it easier, I suppose, to fight for my mates.
Excellent. Gareth, I feel like I could talk to you for absolutely hours, but instead I'm going to let you go because I'm guessing you're going to be watching the Gloucester match, well, immediately after this, actually.
Yeah, I'm gonna shoot down and watch that. One of my mates is the Stade Français coach as well, so it's
Oh, who's that?
Greg Cooper.
Oh,
So he
okay.
talking to Coops, the last couple of days. So, but I think the Gloucester bond's a bit too strong, mate, to wish him too well. But it
Yeah.
should be a great game.
A quick prediction for that?
Well, it's hard to call, mate. I think I'm hoping Gloucester sneak it by a couple.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with Gloucester, but only just. Where can we find you on social media, stuff like
Yeah, mate. Also, I'm on Twitter as at G Delve, and I've been lucky enough and doing quite a bit at the moment with BBC Wales on the radio and TV, so Scrum 5. So hopefully I'll be spouting my opinions elsewhere for a little bit longer.
Well, let's absolutely hope so.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
And you're welcome back on the podcast whenever you want.
Brilliant. Thanks, JB.